Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. There are thousands of podcasts out there. You chose this one. It's your thing. Listening choices are part of who you are. And the choice to support your favorite NPR program is yours, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to donate to your station. Then share why that's the kind of person you are. Tweet or create a public Facebook post with the hashtag WhyPublicRadio.
I'm broadcasting today from WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, ahead of tomorrow's special Senate election that has captivated the country. The candidates are Democrat Doug Jones, a former federal prosecutor, and Republican Roy Moore, a former state judge. Moore has been accused by a number of women of sexual misconduct or assault decades ago when the women were in their teens and 20s. Moore won a primary against Republican Luther Strange, who's been serving as one of Alabama's senators since Jeff Sessions left Congress to lead the Department of Justice. We found Mark Gray at a Walmart outside Birmingham. He says he's voting for Roy Moore regardless.
I believe in a man's principles. I mean, he stands up for what he believes in.
Did any of these allegations change your mind at all, or what did you think about them?
Nah. I'm thinking, why wait 37 years to bring it up?
You don't believe them?
No, I don't.
Did you think about voting for Doug Jones?
I thought about it. I don't know. Man's record just don't speak too loud, to me.
He's not with you on the issues?
I don't think so. Uh-huh. I wouldn't. I'm not going to vote for him.
Would you have voted for Luther Strange if he had been the candidate for
the
Republicans?
Big Luther? Yeah, I sure would. Yeah, I would have. Yeah.
Does President Trump's endorsement of Moore mean anything to you? Did that sway you
really.
One way or the other?
Yeah, not really.
Not really?
No. I'm going to vote who I want to vote for,
At the public library in Vestavia Hills, we met several Moore voters of different stripes, starting with Joe Dixon.
I've been a Republican since all of my life. I just haven't seen anything like this. I can't support the judge on this one.
You can't support Judge Moore?
I can't support him.
Why not?
Well, I'm also a lawyer, and you have to obey the laws even when you don't agree with them. You've gone through all the courts, and the court said, don't do this, and you ignore what the court says. You don't have any respect for the law. So he's 70 years old. I don't see any improvement.
So it's really more about him being removed from the bench than the recent allegations against
him. The allegations, I have six daughters, and the allegations are real mean. And I think he's done a good job of dodging somebody with the real questions, because he picks the places he go to. If he's that innocent, he can come out and people can question him and they can look at him. But I believe the women. I don't think that they would just come forward like this and accuse him of something, knowing the power that he has. So I have to go with the women on this. And
so that, who are you going to vote for?
On the last one, I wrote my name in. I knew I wasn't going in place. Mm. But I think I'll go with Doug.
You will?
He's from Fairfield, and I was raised in Fairfield. So he's a good boy.
Let me turn to you, Mika McBride. You are a Democrat.
Yeah, I don't know that I would necessarily say I'm a Democrat.
Really?
The last couple of elections, I voted more for the Democratic Party, but I voted both ways in the past. And, for me, the important things are healthcare, education, just wanting the best for my family and for the people in Alabama. And looking at the candidates right now and hearing what they have to say about the issues, I really think Doug Jones is the only one who actually cares about the issues that matter here. And so, yeah, I'm supporting Doug Jones in this one.
Did the allegations make any difference to you?
Yeah, in that I'm not originally from Alabama, so I had vague memories of Roy Moore and just the things he'd done with the Ten Commandments and the same-sex marriage and all that, and already felt like he was someone who didn't really respect the law and didn't respect the Constitution and put his own views above his constituents. And so I wasn't going to vote for Roy Moore, but I will say the allegations have, and how he's handled them especially, just seeing him go back and forth in interviews and not stick to a clear story and just really malign the names of these women who've come forward has made me even more confident, not only that I would not vote for him, but that I would be really sad if he's who represents our state, if he's who wins.
Okay, finally, I want to turn over here to Jeff Vreeland. Jeff, what's your plan for Tuesday?
I never reveal who I vote for. I haven't done that my entire life. It was advice my dad gave me. Said, if you ever let people know, it's going to open up very difficult conversations. So I won't be letting anyone know, but it is a very hard decision, I think.
Why? What's difficult about it?
I think many Republicans, as I am a Republican, been a lifelong Republican, I think it is very difficult for Republicans right now. Luther Strange is a friend of mine. I've been friends with Luther for probably 10, 12 years now. And it's definitely difficult for me. I was a big Luther supporter. I donated time and money. It was a tough loss for him. But I think Republicans right now are concerned about some of the allegations that Roy Moore has been accused of. But at the same time, there's some deep, deep issues with Doug Jones that Republicans and conservatives and moderates have with him. I think the issue of him being pro-choice is one that's going to deeply hurt him, has deeply hurt him in this election, and it's one that I take personally as probably the single biggest issue as I'm a pro-life.
Abortion is the most important issue.
For me it is, and I am pro-life. And so Doug has been very vocal about the fact that he is not. And I think that's a very difficult decision for me to come to if I was going to support him. So that's kind of my plan for Tuesday.
Some voters here in Alabama ahead of tomorrow's special election. We'll be hearing from more people throughout the show today and at our website, hereandnow.org.
Meanwhile, a 27-year-old police have identified as Aikayat Ula is in custody in New York today after police say he detonated an improvised low-tech explosive device attached to his body with Velcro and zip ties, injuring himself and three others as he walked in a tunnel between New York's Port Authority and the Times Square train station. Here's Mayor Bill de Blasio this morning.
And let's be also clear, this was an attempted terrorist attack. Thank God the perpetrator did not achieve his ultimate goals.
NPR's Joel Rose is in New York. Joel, this was 7:30 this morning, rush hour and high holiday season in New York and Times Square. It is amazing that only three besides the alleged bomber were injured. How are those three, first of all? And when the mayor says he didn't achieve his goals, is it thought the device went off prematurely?
Well, first of all, the three people who are injured other than the suspect suffered remarkably non-life-threatening injuries. Mm-hmm. I mean, as police describe it, they suffered none of the severe burns or anything like that that the alleged suspect – that the suspect suffered. The bystanders were just treated for ringing in the ears and headaches. And really, it doesn't seem like they suffered anything life-threatening at all, which is remarkable because, mm-hmm. as you say, this happened at rush hour in a corridor in a busy Times Square subway station that's just a few hundred feet from Port Authority, from the busiest bus terminal in the country. And, you know, for people to suffer a relatively minor injury suggests that either the bomb was not very powerful or it did not fully detonate. I don't think we know yet. Mm. Police haven't said yet which they believe to be the case, but I mean, certainly this incident, either way, could have been a lot worse.
What do we know about Aikayat Ula?
Not much so far. I mean, police have identified him as 27-year-old Aikayat Ula. We believe he lives in Brooklyn. We're not exactly clear on where. The police seem to be searching at several different locations across the borough. He's thought to be an immigrant from Bangladesh. But, you know, beyond that, we really don't have much of a picture of him yet.
No, that will form. But meantime, NYPD Commissioner James O'Neill was asked if there was any connection to ISIS. He said the suspect did make statements but declined to elaborate. So we don't know much more there either, but do we know what police are doing to try to get some of these answers?
Well, we know that they're interviewing eyewitnesses who were, you know, there in the corridor this morning. They'll be studying video footage. I mean, apparently the explosion was caught on video, and, you know, they'll be studying those images to see if there's any clues there. And they're also, police and FBI are in Brooklyn. They're looking for information, presumably from friends and relatives of the suspect. Again, just trying to get a fuller picture, you know, of him and what might have been a motivation.
Yeah, well, look, New Yorkers just keep on walking. They keep on, you know, keep on. But this must have been quite shocking this morning. We understand that people could hear the explosion, so there was, you know, a lot of people running just because they heard something.
And there's just so many people in an area like that at rush hour. I mean, you know, Port Authority has hundreds of thousands of commuters go through there. 7 o'clock in the morning is, you know, obviously peak commuting time. And it's, you know, 42nd Street and 8th Avenue. It's right in, it's a block from Times Square. It's right in the heart of the west side of Midtown near the Lincoln Tunnel. I mean, it's, you know, this is one of the busiest corners in New York City. It's pretty remarkable that this wasn't, you know, it wasn't much worse.
But you know, we know, and we only have a minute here, but we know so much has been done in that area to try to, you know, barriers, and because there have been other attempts with cars to, you know, do damage there. Is there a sense among New Yorkers of what do you do with a guy walking around with, apparently eyewitnesses saw wires coming out of his body?
Well, there are a lot of, NYPD has a major, large detail, thousands of officers assigned to patrol in the subways, and they're very visible, especially at the bigger stations like Times Square. But that said, there's hundreds of subway stations and hundreds of miles of track in the city, and it is, you know, you can't be everywhere.
It's a frightening thought. NPR's Joel Rose in New York. Again, Joel, thank you.
You're welcome.
Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton is still one of the hottest tickets on Broadway.
I'm a diamond in the rough, a shiny piece of coal, trying to reach my goal, my power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is older. These New York City streets get cold, I shoulder every burden.
But its fabulous doppelganger is about to end its run.
I'm on a roll, but sometimes I screech notes unreachable. When I was 19, but my throat was much older. These New York critics get cold, I shoulder every burden. But now
Spamilton is the parody from playwright and satirist Gerard Alessandrini, who also created the award-winning parody review Forbidden Broadway, which ran almost uninterrupted in New York for 25 years. Spamilton takes on the truth that, especially when it first started, Hamilton left no oxygen in the room for other shows. It parodies Hamilton's best-known actors, including, of course, creator Lin-Manuel Miranda, but it also adds scenes from Book of Mormon and a Barbra Streisand impersonator. It was such a hit it moved from off-Broadway to the 47th Street Theater, but it has to close to make way for another production. The producers are planning a U.S. tour. Last year, we sat down with Gerard Alessandrini before a performance off-Broadway at the Tiny Triad Theater.
So, Gerard, how many other playwrights, producers have come up to you and said, why didn't I think of that?
A few, including Lin-Manuel Miranda, said, I didn't think of that, because he's a smart guy. And he could have written the parody himself, I'm sure, if he wanted to. A lot of the ideas in Spamilton, spoofing Hamilton, are very obvious. It's just hopefully we've done them well.
Well, and yes, you have, according to the many extensions you keep getting. Why? I mean, what was your light bulb?
Well, you know, I had done Forbidden Broadway for many years, a show that spoofed Broadway shows, new and old and current and past. And by
the way, let's go there for a second. What was that thought process taking beloved plays into parody?
Well, parody is nothing new. That's been going on for centuries. So it was just, I guess I just came up with the idea of doing all Broadway musicals, all Broadway shows, all the time.
So what might be some examples of how you might spoof other shows in Forbidden Broadway?
Well, there were different levels to do it. You could spoof The Star, which was always fun, especially in the beginning, because there were a lot of stars on Broadway. That was even the era when Yul Brynner was still doing The King and I and Rex Harrison. There were new stars like Patti LuPone. The movie of Evita, she wasn't going to get to do it. Don't Cry for Me, Barbara Streisand, because back then there was rumors that Barbara Streisand was going to do it.
Don't cry for me, Barbara Streisand. The truth is I never liked you.
Patti LuPone is actually a favorite spoof. Then I would do the shows. I would like spoof a whole show, like Les Miserables became More Miserables. We would do a medley of numbers from them. Instead of God on High, it was God is High, this song's too high, bring it down. Those were some.
They were singing higher and higher and higher.
Right. And then there was also the fantasy spoofs of when we'd put like one season Cabaret and a revival of The Sound of Music were on Broadway at the same time. And if you know, they're both taking place basically in the same era, in the same place, right? So I put them together.
Oh!
do cabaret is slightly overrated. The times have changed and Sound of Music's dated.
You know, I basically had dedicated my life to doing it. So when Hamilton came along, I thought, well, gee, this is the biggest hit show that I've experienced in New York since I've been here. Well, if I spoofed Broadway shows for 25 years, I better get busy and spoof Hamilton. Now, Hamilton provided a little different type of parody because it's such a phenomenon, and people immediately started learning the songs, knowing them. So I was just at the bank, an hour ago, and a little, he must have been three at the most, maybe two and a half. Boy came in, so cute, and he was singing, "Look around, look around." He was singing the whole song. So that helps us because if people know the lyrics, what I do is change the lyrics, you know, turn them inside out, mangle the song. So the more you know the song, the funnier it is.
So here you are, perfectly primed for Hamilton. Everything was, it sounds like, was leading up to this moment. So what jumped out at you from Hamilton where you said, we have to go after that?
My shot. That song. And because that's the one, when you see the show, you think, oh my God, Broadway's back, because it's exciting. It's clear what the leading character wants. And I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. And yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. Lin-Manuel was singing it as Hamilton. As Hamilton, he's just come to New York. He wants to put his ideas across. He meets other people who are interested in the American Revolution, and he's very succinct about what he wants and how he's driven to do it. It does the work of a charm song that you'd find in a Rodgers Hammerstein show. And I thought, well, it really shouldn't be about Hamilton. It should be about Lin-Manuel Miranda. So he sings, "I'm not gonna let Broadway rot.
I am not gonna let Broadway rot. I am not gonna let Broadway rot. Hey yo, I'm just like a savior with Beyonce behavior, and I love being a hot big shot. We're really, really hot. I dream
of fine." So I thought, oh, okay, then the story has to be how Lin-Manuel arrives at putting this new type of musical theater together.
So he's come to see it. Twice.
Well, has come to see the show, yes. I think he liked it.
Reports were that he was laughing so hard that he was disturbing people around him.
I don't think he was disturbing anybody. Maybe his presence was disturbing. He came with Tommy Keel, the fabulous director that directed that show. And he came with Alex Lacamoire, who did the vocal arrangements, which are also outstanding and very, very advanced for what Broadway usually gives you. They stayed after the show, and he talked to the cast. He tweeted that he laughed until his brains came out or something like that. Then he came back a few weeks ago with his family, with his wife and his in-laws.
This is quite a compliment.
Yes, I think it is. Well, you know, I had asked him for some suggestions how to sharpen the show, because we were in previews the first time he came. They suggested moving some numbers. One number they thought was sort of a miss, so I rewrote it. I mean, it's amazing. I just saw the show a few weeks ago, and I felt kind of bad because it's so well written, and I've just mangled the songs to death. On some level, it must be wonderful, but on another level, it must be awful for him to sit there and hear what we did to the songs.
Or to the plot, because, for instance, you have President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama going to sleep listening to a recording of the Hamilton sound.
It's your choice, Hamilton, Hamlet, or Ham.
In New York.
New York, just you wait.
Lin-Manuel is Hamilton.
He's the Hammond's Hamilton.
What's that about?
Well, as any good Democrat might know, John F. Kennedy evidently went to sleep listening to the cast album of Camelot, which was a hit show in its day, a lovely show. And now we call that era of Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy the Camelot era. And I know that the Obamas loved Hamilton, so I thought, wouldn't it be nice to fantasize that they do like the Kennedys did, that they go to sleep listening to the cast album of Hamilton.
So one of the songs from Hamilton that you spoof is "The Room Where It Happens." You've changed it to "I Want to Be in the Film When It Happens."
That's the one that Lin-Manuel said to me, I wish I thought of that. I thought that was obvious because Barbra Streisand gave out the award for Best Musical for the Tonys this year. She came out in her revolutionary garb.
Thank God I picked the right outfit. The Tony goes to Hamilton.
I thought for a minute that's exactly what she was going to say. I want to be in the film where it happens. So.
The big finale, Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story, becomes Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Cries. Because everybody does, right?
Right. It's his wife, you know, telling about how the legacy is carried on and what she did afterwards. Of course, I've exaggerated points, but there are real lines in there. Like, you know, I built the first orphanage in New York City, and we just exaggerated them slightly. I don't want to give it away, but...
Well, no, I mean, the fact that you have lines from Hamilton and you have the music, although completely, as you said, mangled, it's getting great reviews. But do you think people are also coming because, hey, we can't see Hamilton, we can't afford it, we'll go see Spamilton?
Yeah, I think maybe they are.
My name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things I haven't done.
You're obviously someone who loves theater.
Yes.
What does it do for you when a show like this does come along and, you know, people who are involved with theater just get gobsmacked? Like, look at that, you know?
Well, Hamilton, it just made me rejoice. Because I really felt from spoofing Broadway shows for so many years that it was like a dead art. I mean, there were wonderful revivals of shows that we've all loved for many decades. There were jukebox musicals that brought back music from eras. They were entertaining themselves, but they weren't real theater. They weren't presenting any new ideas. And I miss that. You know, I grew up, you know, with Sondheim and, you know, in the 70s when you'd go see shows, I was a young boy. And every show, not just Sondheim, had a new way of presenting songs in the story. Even Annie and Grease and Chorus Line. And you never knew what you were going to get. It was always a surprise. And so I'm very grateful to the creators of Hamilton, and I was thrilled that Hamilton came along. I can't say that rap was my cup of tea, but it's just great that they found a new way to present musical theater with a new type of music.
What you're saying is, this is your gift to Lin-Manuel Miranda, mangling his songs.
I don't know. I was sitting in that theater watching Hamilton last week feeling very guilty. Grateful that he hasn't come down on me, but he must have a big heart. And somebody's laughing, and that makes me feel good.
Bird, check what we got. Dubby Diggs, my pet, hard rock like Lancelot.
Gerard Alessandrini backstage at his then off-Broadway show, Spamilton. That show ends its Broadway run in January, but keep an eye out for the U.S. tour. You're listening to Here and Now. Those fires in Southern California continue today. Hundreds of square miles of land have been scorched, thousands forced from homes. Over the weekend, firefighters in Los Angeles and San Diego County did make progress in four of the remaining fires. They're now all more than 80% contained. But the Thomas Fire in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties is just 15% contained, and it's threatening coastal cities like Carpinteria. Lance Orozco is news director at KCLU. He's in Carpinteria. Lance, we're hearing people are using masks when they just run their errands because of the ash. What are you seeing?
People, they've kind of made their peace with it for now, I think, but everybody has a mask. In fact, a relief agency here in town passed out almost 100,000 masks during the last couple of days. But as I look up from the hills here, I'm in front of Carpinteria High School. You can see little bits of fire burning on the mountain right now. It's calmed down a little bit. When it was dark here still, it looked like you had some gigantic 40 or 50 foot high flames. And now with the daybreak, the wind has eased off a little bit. So it looks like just a series of bonfires in the mountains above Carpinteria.
Well, it's pretty frightening. Let's explain to people. I mean, I once lived along the Pacific Coast Highway right below Santa Monica, where there's a strip of land and then a tiny strip of highway and then a strip of homes right on the ocean. And when there was a fire threatening there once years ago, we had to get in kayaks and go out into the water. I mean, what would happen in this coastal town if the fires did come over?
Well, the problem is different in different parts of this community. In Carpinteria, there's the mountain range, and then there's some agricultural fields. There's some avocados and things like that. And then there's the city proper, which is next to Highway 101, which is the main north-south highway between San Francisco and Los Angeles. So there's a little bit of a buffer. But as you move up the coast another 8 miles into Montecito, and Montecito, of course, is famous. It's home to Oprah Winfrey and Ellen DeGeneres and a lot of other celebrities, a lot of mansions. Those mansions go right up into the mountains. And a couple of years ago, we had a huge fire, actually a pair of fires, the Tia and Jesus fires, that burned almost 400 homes in those areas. And that's the concern, is the fire is pushing west. And in fact, some of the celebrities like Oprah and Ellen DeGeneres have had to evacuate their homes.
Well, so that's where it might be headed. Is there a sense that Carpentaria is going to be spared again, this coastal town?
There's a lot of optimism here. People feel, yes, they're going to be okay. They've watched the fire burn now for about 36 hours in the mountains, and most of the fire now is moving onto the backside of the mountains, and as you go north out of Carpinteria, it's just a wilderness area, so it's burning up into the wilderness area and away from the coastline.
Okay. You've seen a lot of fires, I'm assuming, in your time there, 25 years covering them. This is now the fifth largest wildfire in modern California history. You know, just your sense of how people are reacting to this.
Well, I think for a lot of people who've lived here a long time, this has thrown them for a loop, because what we're used to is big fires that pop up. Every couple of years we have a big fire, and unfortunately it'll usually burn sometimes a couple of hundred homes in Santa Barbara or Ventura counties. But usually what happens is it starts, and the first 12 hours it causes a lot of destruction, and then the winds calm down and there's enough fire resources around to try to be able to get a handle on it. And this fire seems to keep going and going and going. And you know, Carpinteria is 26 miles away from where the fire started.
Yeah.
And threatening homes almost a week later. And that's just something kind of unheard of for fires in this region.
Very frightening. Lance Orozco, news director at KCLU in Santa Barbara County in California. Lance, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm broadcasting from WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama today ahead of the special Senate election tomorrow. Former President Obama has reportedly recorded a robocall for Doug Jones, the Democrat in the race to fill Attorney General Jeff Sessions' Senate seat. And President Trump has recorded a robocall for Republican Roy Moore, who has been dogged by accusations of sexual misconduct with teenagers back in the 1970s. Let's bring in Andrew Yeager, who's a host and reporter here at WBHM in Birmingham and has been covering this race. Hi, Andrew.
It's great to be with you.
And Roy Moore did an interview with the TV program Voice of Alabama Politics yesterday, where he denied knowing the women who have accused him of unwanted touching when they were teenagers and he was in his 30s. Let's listen.
I do not know them. I had no encounter with them. I never molested anyone. And for them to say that, I don't know why they're saying it, but it's not true.
Another denial from Roy Moore. This has been a big part of this race. Where does this race stand now?
Well, this race right now is pretty much as close as you can get. We've seen polling, generally speaking, in the days after the allegations came out. You had Roy Moore take a hit, but he seems to have crawled back to, in some polls, with a lead. I think the average generally shows Roy Moore with a couple of points lead, but it's oftentimes within the statistical margin of error. So it really is, you know, neck and neck, as close as it can be.
Now, he has not been on the campaign trail really for almost a week. He didn't go to church yesterday. What is his strategy?
Well, this is a candidate who is not like any other candidate. His campaign staff say, we're using social media, we're getting the word out, but he's just not doing that in the traditional way. He does have an event scheduled for this evening in South Alabama with former Trump strategist Steve Bannon.
Right.
So he does have that on the schedule. But yeah, Roy Moore, he is such a such a personality, such a figure, that he can kind of campaign just on that alone. And at least in the past, has been successful without having that traditional campaign approach.
Let's listen to Doug Jones, the Democrat here. Here he is campaigning on Saturday outside of the historic Brown Chapel AME Church in Selma.
This campaign has got the wind of its back because we are bringing people together from all across the state. We have gotten thousands of volunteers because we care about issues that we have in common, not issues that are dividing us.
What's the Doug Jones strategy going into this race?
I think the Doug Jones strategy is what you heard there in that clip, the idea that I can be a candidate that brings people together, because even before these allegations came out against Roy Moore, he was a divisive figure. He'd been kicked off the state Supreme Court twice before, so he had some baggage to begin with. And so Doug Jones has to be that voice, or is trying to be that voice, to say to disaffected Republicans, people who don't like Roy Moore, I can be an acceptable alternative, and that's why you should send me to the Senate.
How big of a deal is it, though, for disaffected Republicans that Doug Jones is pro-choice? We've heard a lot of people say that abortion is a very important issue to them here.
It's huge. I think in terms of social issues, that's probably the single biggest factor. I've been in conversation with a number of conservative voters, right-leaning voters who clearly do not like Roy Moore, do not want to vote for Roy Moore, but they are troubled by the fact that Doug Jones is a supporter of abortion rights. I've heard a couple of people say to me, you know, I could vote with I could vote for Doug Jones with a clear conscience if he were pro-life. So, yeah, that's a significant factor in this race.
Now, Doug Jones has brought in a number of Democrats from around the country to campaign for him. We mentioned the robocall from President Obama. This is New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, an African-American Democrat in the Senate, campaigning for Jones yesterday.
Get the politics for a second. Alabama needs help with more infrastructure dollars. Alabama needs help with more expanding broadband in this state. Alabama needs help for public education in this state. You, whatever senator you send down there, send somebody that the Republicans are going to work with and the Democrats are going to work with.
There's clearly a strategy on the part of the Jones campaign to try to boost African-American support and turnout in this state.
Well, if Doug Jones is going to win, they have to do that. African-American supporter, African-American voters are about a quarter of the electorate. And yeah, if Doug Jones is going to win, he has to get them to the polls. And we've seen some reporting over the last couple of weeks that questions whether or not there's an enthusiasm gap, that you're seeing enough African-Americans who traditionally vote Democratic will actually go out and vote on December 12th in the midst of the holiday season in just a special election when there's nothing else on the ballot. So clearly, this last couple of days, a move by the Jones campaign to try to reach those voters and get them to actually make that step to go to the polls.
What's the get out the vote strategy for Roy Moore's campaign? Who does he need to turn out?
Well, he needs to turn out a lot of rural conservative voters. That's where his base is. That's typically where he does best.
That's what he did in the primary.
And he needs those voters. And sort of the conventional wisdom with Roy Moore is that he has this core group, this core constituency that is with him no matter what. But at the same time, he also tends to perform less well than other Republicans statewide. So he's got to get his core supporters out, particularly in rural areas, and hope that there aren't enough moderate Republicans that will vote for Doug Jones.
There was a 2011 interview that surfaced over the weekend in which Moore called for getting rid of every amendment after the 10th. That would include the 14th Amendment guaranteeing citizenship and equal rights to former slaves, and the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote. Are these kinds of things being talked about, or is this something just the national media is looking back at this old interview and nobody here cares?
There's certainly people here who do care about that. I'm sure. I think the bigger issue is we're 24 hours away from this election, and I think many people have made up their minds, and so the idea that one more detail, one more forgotten interview will swing that many people, I think, it may just be white noise at this point.
All right. I want to listen to one more piece of tape. This is Alabama's senior senator, Richard Shelby. He said yesterday that he understood why President Trump endorsed Roy Moore, but he couldn't do the same. He wrote in another Republican's name.
I tell you what, there's a time, we call it a tipping point, and I think so many accusations, so many cuts, so many drip, drip, drip. When it got to the 14-year-old story, that was enough for me. I said, I can't vote for Roy Moore.
Andrew, how big a deal is that?
I think it's pretty notable. I think, one, it allows Republicans sort of permission to not vote for Roy Moore. But also, you've seen Doug Jones seize on those comments, and he has ads out, online ads using those words. And to have your senior Republican senator not supporting your Republican candidate, that's pretty significant.
This is obviously a very busy time here in Alabama. And in our last 2 minutes, we are joined by a surprise guest here, Virginia Martin, who's the lead news editor of Birmingham Watch. Virginia, we've just been talking about all of the different aspects of this race, but where do you see it standing right now?
I really think it's too close to call at this point. Your polls have been
up a few here, down a few there, all within the margin of error, which is usually huge on this race.
And what do you think that this attention has done for Alabama? Has this been good or bad?
No,
or what
nothing
do you think?
Good. I don't nothing think this good. Has done anything good from Alabama, for Alabama. I think it's just sort of underlined the redneck country folks who marry off their 14-year-olds. And
what are you going to be watching for tomorrow?
Turnout. I think anybody would say that. Turnout in Jefferson County, for one, because Jefferson
County— That's
where
Birmingham is.
That's where Birmingham is. And Jefferson County leans the most Democratic in races like this. So if you don't see a lot of people at the polls in certain areas, then it is not good for Doug Jones.
And what do you think about the role that President Trump has played in this race? Has that been important to voters?
I think it has, to an extent. But they seem to also have a love for Trump and a love for Moore in separate boxes, almost.
Hmm.
And one of the things, I know that there are a lot of people who would say absolutely nothing bad about Roy Moore, but one of the problems we have had trying to interview people is that the ones who are, you know, big Moore supporters still start out with, he did this, but I have to still support him. They still start out with his deficits, and I'm not exactly sure why.
Well, we'll have to see what happens if Moore is elected, whether these stories continue to dog him in these allegations. That's Virginia Martin, lead news editor of Birmingham Watch, and Andrew Yeager, host and reporter here at WBHM in Birmingham. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
With the latest numbers on unemployment and job creation released on Friday, we have a pretty solid picture of what hiring looked like in 2017. On average this year, the U.S. created 174,000 jobs a month, which is strong. But in the same 11 months last year, the U.S. averaged around 13,000 more a month, 189,000. Meanwhile, GDP growth has sped up. We've seen some wage growth. The president spent much of his campaign promising job growth. And remember, in September at the U.N., he touted a accomplishments like the record high stock market, lowest unemployment in 16 years, companies moving back and creating jobs the likes of which we've never seen. Well, let's check it out with Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does every Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Robin.
Now, we should start with a caveat that you've also written that the president, all presidents, really don't impact the economy as much as the economy impacts them. But start with manufacturing jobs. Where are we there?
Well, manufacturing clearly rebounded in 2017. It was a little bit flat last year, and the sector added 160,000 jobs this year. That's the most since 2014. And this is it's clearly good news. What is it about? What caused it? You know, is it animal spirits? Is it manufacturers who got a rush of optimism since last November because of Trump? I can't rule it out entirely. I haven't spoken to every manufacturing company in America and, you know, can report that none of them credited Trump. But I think it's really important to remember that manufacturing jobs are driven by demand, not only domestic demand, but also overseas demand, exports. And demand from Europe and Asia has been really strong in the last 12 months. Global trade has been on fire in 2017, and this is one of the reasons why the stock market's been up as well. I want to point out that this factor is a little bit ironic under Trump because many people thought that he might spark a trade war with China and other countries to make sure that we raised the value of the dollar. And instead, we've really seen the opposite. We've seen extraordinary global trade, which has probably helped manufacturing jobs overall.
Well, there's another irony, too, because there's a group called Reshoring Initiative, and they talk about something called reshoring, which is U.S. firms bringing jobs back or foreign companies locating jobs here. And they found that more and more companies were doing this, one because of the exchange rate for the U.S. dollar. But the other is there was an expectation among businesses that President Trump would cut taxes and cut regulation and, as you said, might erect tariffs or punish goods that were produced overseas. So people have, you know, policy can or promise of policy can make businesses, you know, create jobs.
Oh, there's no question about that. I mean, absolutely, not only policy that exists, but policy that you think might exist in the future is going to, you know, potentially affect job creation. You know, we don't know yet what's going to happen with the corporate tax cut, although it is very clearly, it's, you know, the corporate tax cut itself, the centerpiece of the bill, is a $1 trillion transfer to C-Corps, the largest companies, which often tend to be multinational. So that clearly is something that has, you know, driven their forecasts and moved up the stock market. At the the same time, it's a little bit ironic to talk about, you know, its effect on small companies, because one of the holdups with the corporate tax cut has actually been its effect on the pass-through rate. That is what our tax is going to look like for smaller companies that aren't necessarily listed on NASDAQ or on the Dow. And there, you know, that's something where I think a lot of Republican sort of tax wonks and observers are sort of, you know, throwing their hands up and saying, we don't know what's going to happen with this rate. But because that plan has been written so quickly, in fact, a lot of people are saying it could be open season for tax lawyers to basically do whatever they want to with that rate. So I guess in summation to your point, yes, clearly the Trump administration has been a deregulatory machine in the last few months. That has been something they've done very successfully. Passing major legislation has been tougher, but it does look like we are going to get some kind of corporate tax cut in the next few months, yeah. I would bet.
Well, and, you know, people have compared the job growth to the Obama years and have said, well, wait a second, it's actually less under Trump. But is that a fair comparison? Because, you know, the Obama years were recovering from the terrible crash and recession, so there were more jobs to add. I guess I'm saying overall, how would you say a President Trump has impacted the economy?
Yeah, this is a good question, and let me couch it first before I answer it directly. I think it's important to know that whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you have to be really humble about what the president can actually do when it comes to the economy. The president cannot pass a tax cut. The president cannot pass a stimulus. Economic policy is very much in the realm of the Senate and the Congress because they have the power of the purse. So the president can nudge them one way or the other. He can sign on the dotted line at the end of the day once there is a bill passed through both houses of Congress, but he can't do it all by himself. That's number one. Number two, I think it's most important to think about economic climate as like sort of literal climate. You know, the same way the president can't control hurricanes and snowstorms, the president can't control demand coming out of China, demand coming out of Europe, and recessions happening overseas that very much affect particularly those companies that are reliant on exports. So, you know, what has the president done to help the economy? Well, look, on the one hand, you could say the president has clearly created a climate of deregulation, and that might certainly help companies. On the other hand, I think a liberal could say the president has been at the helm of a lot of chaos, and that sort of uncertainty scares companies. So it is very difficult to say one way or the other.
Report card not in. Derek Thompson, senior editor of The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in Birmingham, Alabama. This is Here and Now.